is working? Okay. Okay, there were four religious groups that were still favorable to the use of Alaskan Native languages, namely the Russian Orthodox, still continuing his previous policy. Second, the Moravians settling in Bethel and Central Yupik exclusively. Three, the Catholics, mainly in Central Yupik also. And four, the Episcopalians or Anglicans from the Canadian side in many of the Athabascan areas, and Point Hope, who many of these groups published materials in Alaska Native languages, religious materials, during this second period after the neglect from the 1880s to the 1910s, which I have to characterize as a period of cross currents. The mainstream Protestants who believed in suppressing, exclusively in suppressing languages, and the oddball groups just mentioned, not so American, who not so mainstream American, who believed in using the languages, at least in church. Well, what happened, that conflict was resolved with a decision pretty well all around that no native languages to be used in any schools, although you're free to use them in church on Sunday if you want. But thus initiated by 1910s, a period of almost universal suppression of Alaska Native languages. And 50 years of that brings you to 1960, the year of my arrival. And there were already many communities, like the one I first went to, Minto, where there was nobody back then under the age of 30 or 40, who spoke the language. And most of the villages throughout the state, already at least the children were no longer able to speak the language. It isn't true yet in every case, but maybe 15 or 20 villages altogether in Alaska are there still children who can come to school speaking an indigenous language. So that's the picture, you might say. In addition to that, there was absolutely no, or virtually no, American linguistics or study or documentation of Alaska Native languages, far be it from the UA Anthro Department, which never had any interest in Alaska Native languages, and still to this day has absolutely no interest in Alaska Native languages. Even the linguists within the Anthropology Department have not done any work on Alaska Native languages as such. In fact, virtually all of the linguistics that had been done on Alaska Native languages during the 20th century, or at least from 1910 to 1960, were all Scandinavians. Wilhelm Stefansson, for example, Icelander, and the Danes, Holtved and Hamarik, and of course Bergslan, and even Iak was basically Scandinavian led. So that practically all the work done during the period 1910 to 1950 to 1960 was done by Scandinavians. And nothing done by the University of Alaska or any Americans really from anywhere. But at the same time as I came, the Summer Institute of Linguistics Wycliffe Bible Translators had set up a headquarters in Fairbanks too, and they had various people working with some of the less moribund languages of Alaska, although not all less moribund, and I could go into that, but I maybe do it in the written form of this. And at the same time, I began this kind of work at the university. And the reason or exactly how that happened, there's a famous photograph of me. When I came in the fall of 1960, I taught a course in linguistics to introduce linguistics to the university. Two of the students in there, one was Irene Reed, and the other Martha Tiluk, who happened to live in the same prefab apartment house along College Road near the across the street from what's now Mike's Chevron, no longer there. We're neighbors in that little prefab apartment building. And the two of them were already friends, and Irene had just arrived. They sort of ganged up on me in that linguistics course to get me to start teaching already by January 1961 a course in Eskimo, which was based on Martha Tiluk's native Yupik, and where Irene was what you want to call it, chief student, and my job was, or student leader, and my job was to really emcee the whole thing. And there's a photograph of me doing just that at a blackboard with Irene Reed, Martha Tiluk, and Charles Degnan of Unalakleet, and Ambrose Tawarak, Shungnak, and there were six people in that class, four, two Yupiks, two Inupiaks, and Martha and Irene, and there were six, I think, six, and Annette Bork, students, Maggie Panic, all together in that course. And there's that famous photograph of us in that, which definitely belongs, I suppose, in any such presentation of this history. And thus began Alaska Native Languages at UAF. That grew into a curriculum which is still going in Yupik, thanks to the initiative and continued work of Irene and Martha, who the following year took over the course. And it's been going ever since. I, on the other hand, extended my research interests first to Athabaskan and Eyak, and by 1961, I already had none of this, don't forget, not even my teaching, was funded by UA hard money. It was Carnegie money. And I started a research program as a survey of Alaska Native languages, but with various people assisting me on a major grant from the National Science Foundation of $38,000, which would be something like 10 times that much today, to survey the Alaskan Native language situation and start documenting Alaskan languages that were urgently in need of documentation. Irene and Martha worked with Yupik and Aleutiq, and I worked with Athabaskan at Minto, and Robert Austerlitz from Columbia worked in with EAC, and two grad students from UW who ended up not amounting to anything worked with Otten and Tanina. That was the first year of that. Again, strictly on National Science Foundation money, so none of this has ever been directly supported by the University of Alaska. They always got a good, on the contrary, a hefty, overhead mm-hmm. for that. So it isn't as though the credit really belongs to the University of Alaska, even for the teaching, let alone the research. In principle, It was a gentlemanly thing to do at the university, just as it was a gentlemanly thing to do is to collect skulls and arrowheads, because after all, this generous culture couldn't afford to pick up the curios and show them to the museum goers of the quaint past that we have replaced here. And the fact that there were still people walking around above the ground talking their own languages as much as they did still then, well, it was still, given the way the school policy was, it was still a gentlemanly thing to do to teach conjugation of their verbs on a blackboard at a in a university room, or to go off in the summer and do field work to collect these curios of their language for the future language, which are doomed, of course, to extinction. There's nothing the university, knowing that they're doomed to extinction, did consider it a gentlemanly thing to do, so very respectable, to go out and make a record of these disappearing languages. But the very notion of doing anything to help them not disappear was totally anathema, both in the school systems and in at the university, well, that kind of political agitation certainly did not belong at the university.
Are you describing now the mentality of the university or the mentality of
the mentality of the university perfectly befitted the mentality of the white population as a whole. It was the, whatever you want to call it, the pinnacle of our civilization here, but I was able to bring in money, which was always then as now attractive to the university, and I dare say a lot of the work that we did, the university took some pride in being able to say that it was doing this, even though, of course, the money for it came from the National Science Foundation. It took plenty of credit, nevertheless, and during the 1960s, I would have to say that the bulk of my research was, well, ostensibly, at least, went to EAC. In 1961, I had Austerlitz here working on that while I worked with Minto and made some real contributions to the documentation of Minto language and to the study of comparative Athabascan linguistics, explaining a lot about the evolution of Athabascan languages into their differentiated modern forms, which Alaska, of course, is a very rich source for. By 1962, I realized that there was nobody, including Austerlitz, who was going to be able to make the necessary long-term commitment to EAC, which was by far the closest to extinction, which was also by far the most divergent of all of the languages of that family, not counting Tlingit, of course, which had many hundreds of speakers still. But EAC, as a branch of the Athabascan EAC language family, coordinate with the entire family of Athabascan branch of 30-some languages, with then pushing 200,000 speakers of the various languages, mostly Navajo, of course, and EAC with then five speakers left, or four, and then three, and then two, and now one. But the I devoted most of the 1960s to doing as much as I possibly could to, always on NSF money, never on UA money, of course, to document the EAC language before it entirely disappeared. And there was relatively little to do for reversing that loss. The Siak people themselves had been largely wiped out too. But I worked very assiduously with all remaining speakers, first five, then four, then three, then two, now one. And dare say I've been able to come up to make a relatively a permanent record of all that, or very close to all that was left in living memory of EAC, if we're permitted, our archives aren't wiped out, or they've already been severely degraded, and it's a tough situation with that. At the same time, the UPIC program here was growing under Irene's and Martha's care, first given as a special topics in linguistics, namely Eskimo. But by the later 1960s, while I was doing most of my work with Athabaskan and EAC, Irene and company, certainly with my support, because I was also head of the Department of Linguistics and Foreign Languages at first, that I supported as best I could the UPIC curriculum, which we had a hidden underground agenda of elevating to the position of a literary language that could be used in the schools. And we worked very hard with the sound system to develop a practical writing system for the language, which we succeeded in doing. By about 1967, for the most part, although there were touch-ups up to 1972. And by the late 60s, one of the more advanced courses in the UPIC curriculum, which was called the Eskimo Language Workshop, that was the name of a course, a kind of advanced composition for advanced students of UPIC, who immediately went to work writing drafts of readers and reading material for the younger brothers and sisters in school. Getting ready for the day when it would become possible to be allowed to use the UPIC language in school. And as the 60s wore on, what with the developments of further social changes in the country, brought on first by civil rights, by civil rights, and coming for us to a head in the 1967-68 federal legislation permitting bilingual education in the students' initial mother tongues, which certainly applied to parts of Alaska and Eskimo, for example, which we made sure did. We started militating then for an Alaskan bilingual education bill, or not bill, but movement. And one of the first things we needed to do was to show that native languages, in this case, first and foremost Central UPIC, could be used in the schools as a written language to teach children how to read and write, for example, and how to learn in their own language, with a decent writing system which we had devised, and we were all ready to go by the time that was to become allowable. And all the research that we had done at the university in this regard, of course, trying to get more now into the theme of what I always had in mind anyway, was to feed this back, the results of the phonological research, call it that, and grammatical as well, to develop a writing system for Central UPIC so that the people could use their own language in school, for example. and train the teachers on how it worked and so on. And there are various other things that we tried to do. For example, in 1967-68, we brought over, well, due to a meeting of N.O. Christensen with the still then President Wood that I was invited to. There was a day when I was considered, a worthwhile contributor to this university, and got invited to things that, say, the president would. He had the governor of Greenland, the Danish governor of Greenland, over, and we talked about establishing an exchange with maybe Greenlandic students coming to the UA. And first I asked N.O. Christensen, what are you doing here? He wants to study how we Alaskans have managed so successfully to inculcate English into the Eskimo schools he only wishes they could do that with the Danish there, and they're not having the same success we are here. And he admired our success, and that kind of gave me the creeps, but diplomatically, I suggested an exchange, and there was one young, bright young linguist in Greenland that they sent over, and Carl Christian Olsen, or better known as Puyo, who was at this very meeting, by the way, in Quebec there after all those years, and we had become fast colleagues. And part of my interest was also in overcoming the colonial boundaries between people of the same language. So in Yupik, for example, in Alaska, and in Canada, and in Greenland, had a right to know about each other and develop relations with each other. I had visited Barrow. There was not a single map on any wall in any school in Barrow that had Greenland on it, for example. And there was nobody in Barrow knew or had ever heard of Greenland. It was all very, I would say the word carefully, concealed from them. It just, they were totally conquered, totally divided, and they had nothing to do with each other. And I always felt that people, of the same language should have a right, instead of being divided by the colonial map, to continue. That also applied, horror of horrors, between Alaska and the USSR, where you have people on the same side of the same language on the commie side, across from St. Lawrence Island, for example. And those were always things that we had in mind too. And I was always we have the privilege of having maps here and knowledge of what's going, or being able to find out what's going on the other side, relatively speaking, at least. And part of our mission was certainly to help spread knowledge back and forth between the Yupiks of St. Lawrence Island and facing Chukotka Kami mainland, or the Inuit in Canada and Kalaallit in Greenland, to be able to reestablish communications with Alaska across these colonial, or even worse, Cold War lines. So that was always another part of what we were trying to do, which had a great deal to do not only with the nouns and the verbs and the consonants and the vowels, but the people, who are still very definitely moving around and talking above the ground, unlike anything ever so considered in the anthro department. Meanwhile, also locally, or the politics of elevating or helping native languages back into the communities and the schools and so on, instead of the undergoing the pure suppression. So toward the end of the 60s, there were a number of other international things starting to take place, but including a visit, very national, first knowledge that, let's see, the Sami were able to do things internationally in the northern Scandinavia, excluding Russia and Kola Peninsula, up to then, in the late 60s, became apparent in various North American meetings, for example, one in Montreal, which some Alaskan educators went and began to realize that there, at least other countries were trying to allow native languages back in the schools. And at the same time, Mondale and Ted Kennedy visited UAF, among other places in Alaska, as members of the subcommittee, Senate subcommittee on Native education, and they were rather taken aback to note the kind of suppression that was still a general pattern in Alaska, which helped relieve some of this, and by 1969-70, it became possible for Irene to persuade. She was much more diplomatic about this. I was at that particular year on sabbatical, supposedly at MIT, where I was supposed to be retreading my theoretical cogs with transformationalists, but the transformationalists were very busy marching up and down Mass Avenue protesting Vietnam, for example, and so I came back from there more politicized than ever instead of retreaded theoretically. And but in meanwhile, while I was away, Irene persuaded the BIA in the state operated school systems then to experiment with the possibility that children might learn better to read and write and go to school and think academically if they were allowed to do so in a language that they knew. And lo and behold, of course, it proved possible. She did a wonderful job of training those people, and she was asked rather pointedly, Krauss has nothing to do with this, does he? Oh, no, Mike's in way in at MIT. He couldn't be, no, nothing to do with it. And but the experiments went so successfully that the so-called eight-week wonders, there were eight of them, two from four villages each, who had 8 weeks of training with Irene and company in literacy in their own language and how to teach and teach reading in it and so on. It was so dramatically successful that by 1972 it was possible to persuade the state legislature to pass the Alaska Native Language Bill, which did two things. It mandated that children who spoke native a language other than English were to get a curriculum, a teacher, and materials in that language. And point one, and point two, it established at the University of Alaska a Alaska Native Language Center at UAF to do two basic things. One, support the community bilingual programs, and I don't mean by money, because we're never getting that kind of money, but provide the necessary academic scientific support for those, on the one hand, and on the other, to study Alaska Native languages. And I was the director. I defined studying Alaska Native languages not scientific exploitation, but documentation of Alaska Native languages in the form of dictionaries and grammars and literature of texts in the languages, not to enrich directly or for the purpose of enriching linguistics, but for the purpose of linguistics enriching the languages. Naturally, there would be plenty to be gained for linguistics, but that was not the direct purpose. The direct purpose was to support the languages and work with the people who speak these languages to for them to gain these skills, and so the process would become a circular process, mutually enriching academe and academic values and native indigenous values, which are in some ways, God damn it, more, in some ways, in less conflict and in more in tune with each other than academic values and non-academic white towny values, which, you know, go strictly for, I don't know what, but the horror flicks or whatever, that they are at least, and if not more so, native values, native ideas, and so on, are at the very least. Well, and I can certainly shorten that into.
Okay.
Okay. The word that I was looking for there presumably would be compatible or mutually beneficial and profitably interactive, or many phrases that I would need to use in editing this thing. The bill of 1972 that established these was introduced by Joe Josephson and Gary Holthaus. Joe Josephson of the legislature, and they not only allowed but mandated the use of native languages in the Alaskan classrooms where the children spoke a language other than English. They also gave a new add-on of $200,000 to the university for this Alaska Native Language Center, which one has to interpret as the level at which they saw fit, financial level at which they saw fit for the university to have to do this work with. If we had been allowed by the university to keep this $200,000, instead of their constantly draining and chopping away at it, we would now, in order to have just that very bare maintenance of the $200,000 of 1972, would be close now to $900,000. Our present budget is $400,000, and the reason it is so much as $400,000 is because on two occasions, after a 40% cut that we took in 1986, the university took a cut, but we took 40%. Well, ours was always reflected as larger cuts than the university and much smaller raises than the university. That on two occasions, and 2 years in a row, on invited end runs from then Chancellor Patrick O'Rourke, I went to Juneau and got $100,000 more to repair some of the damage done by the university, which again in turn has only been siphoned off. But if I hadn't done that, we would be less than a quarter of the real level at which the legislature in 72 saw fit that we should operate at. And all of that is thanks to the university's way of valuing the Alaska Native Language Center. In addition to that, we've had always gotten a goodly number of grants. One of them, 1978 to 82, from the National Science Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities to produce 10 dictionaries of Alaska Native Languages, which was kind of a folly. They went for it, too. Our batting average with the foundations has always been very, very high because of our good reputation. That there were 10 dictionaries, Haida, Tlingit, Eyak, Atna, Tanana, Kayakan, Aleut, Aleutic, Central Yupik, Siberian Yupik, Inupiaq. And what we have produced so far is the Haida Dictionary is finally about to come out. Lear is still working on the Tlingit. The EAC is more or less finished, but not in a published state. Atna by me. Atna by James Carey was published in the first of the series that came out. And the Tanina is only in the works. Kaya Khan was published recently. Aleut was published in 1990. The Aleutic one is close to publication. Central Yupik, thanks to Steve Jacobson, was done already in, I'll get the years for that, and I'll just go rattle through this list. Edna McLean's Inupiaq is now in the process, and in addition to that, we did one for the Naukan language of East Cape, Alaska, in two editions, a Russian Naukan Russian, and Naukan English, English Naukan. All of these dictionaries are set up in such a way that they may be maximally usable for the people, although they are at the same time not that simple, because especially Eskimo Aleut languages are relatively easy, but Indian languages, especially with a lot of prefixation, are much harder to construct that are user-friendly. But we have always done our very best to make these things user-friendly, because they are all that can and will be retrieved for posterity of the treasury, lexical treasury of each of these languages. And to be given back to the people, as well as to linguistics and university libraries and so on, that they represent the documentation of the language. And granted, that's not the easiest thing to use for third graders, but that's the first job. And from those, dictionaries for third graders can indeed be derived. Without them, they will be, without that, these languages would be lost to posterity, and cannot allow the priority of teaching the language to third graders, so to speak, to eliminate the priority of getting as much of the language as is in living memory recorded while there's before it's too late, because this whole thing is obviously a race against time. In addition to the usual so Boasian description of things, say, or rather Boasian linguistics, which we are doing instead of Anthro, put it that way if you want, or in a division, what turns out to be a very severe division of labor, such that, as I pointed out before, even the linguists in the anthropology department do not do Alaska Native languages, that these the grammar, texts, dictionaries, and of course as much electronic recording as we can do, it needs to be also say fed back to the people or made accessible to the people, and we need to be able to keep it in an archive. And although the legislation doesn't mention archive, obviously we can't throw the work out the window and need to keep it somewhere, which means that we have to place high priority on archiving the stuff. There are about 300 linear feet of material, let's say the length of a football field, of files and materials in and on Alaska Native languages in our archive. that could be cataloged in about 12,000 entry items. And I dare say that the whole center and everything that we've done is an international model that's internationally recognized as the kind of thing that a university should do. And not that the university itself recognizes any of this, this university, but I dare say that we are on a world scale probably the best known center for this kind of work that there is. My next field of notes is all about the relations with the Russian side. And I haven't gone much into the work that each person here has done and so on. And I could maybe detail that, but what I was mainly supposed to be doing, and I'll just try to finish up with that point, is because I'm sure I've exceeded the 8,000 words that I'm supposed to do by about 2-3 times, that there are probably two things that distinguish this center and my work. One is placing the highest value on documentation of endangered languages. And the race against time of doing good field work to get the best possible dictionary, grammar, and compendium of textual material in, that's the Boasian paradigm anyway, of languages, the more endangered, the more urgently in need of being done. And such an enterprise for many years, especially since, say, Chomsky's publication of 1957, that bombshell, has been very steeply devalued in the field of linguistics. That linguistics is the theory of what makes language really tick. And yet that's not what I brought to Alaska. It's, you might say something like Chomsky, although certainly is not here the metaphor breaks down, would be the discoverer of linguistic DNA, which in fact even he wouldn't claim to have done. But it, linguistic theory was so elevated and so enervated, energized by Chomsky, that it became, it eclipsed all other values for linguistics. And as if in biology, the discovery of DNA totally eclipsed the study of speciation and ecology, and why care, for example, about the panda, for example. This DNA is certainly a very trivial interest. Who cares, and it would be idiotic in the case of biology or to cure cancer, to start experimenting on pandas when white rats and maybe fruit flies are so much more, so much handier. Therefore, in linguistics, what do we need Tlingit for, or Siberian Yupik, when we've got English, and okay, if English isn't enough, then you double check Japanese. And so between English and Japanese, that's all you need and to understand what makes language tick. And you don't need any more than you need pandas to understand about DNA.
Because all the basic functions are the same.
Well, it's always going to be, I guess, a double helix and never a triple helix or a double square. Even the panda, or even if I discover a fish that lives in trees and swings with the monkeys, it's still going to only be of trivial interest to the DNAist, although it might be of some considerable interest to some other kinds of butterfly collectors running around with nets, which is the best that could be said of us. More likely, too humble for even that, if we're more like street sweepers or something, digging up or picking up these data from a bunch of languages. What the hell? There is another side to the whole thing, which is the fact that, as we recognize in biology, that there'd be something wrong if the panda goes, or even some stupid snail goes, because there's an ecosystem out there that of interdependent things that forms a world on which our life, by the way, depends, and a biosphere which we can ill exist without. But no one seems to think that about language. They can let them go. No universities need to worry about that, and or what we might do with it. And a few natives would care, maybe, all they've been trained not to, of course. And so why worry? That's I've tried to elevate that business of salvaging the data into something a little bit like two things, maybe. Tom Sawyer whitewashing the fence, where now you'd be surprised who also wants to do it. If you do it right, then you have a reason for it. And secondly, it's part of wallowing in Siberia, that if you're in Siberia, you might as well not pretend you're at Harvard. And be useful to what Alaska needs and not to what somebody needs at Harvard. And this place, as any, so too many provincial universities, have this provinciality complex that seems to, you know, there are more claims to respectability here than anywhere else. Kind of ironic. So that's another reason why maybe our work is not as welcome as it might be, I fancy. But that's one side of my being a misfit. And the other side is what the conference is all about, too, that the idea that there are, the society is organized in a vertical way. Well, that's pretty damn true when it comes to, say, money. It is not true, however, when it comes to intellect and the life of the mind. You'd be surprised. I certainly learned it in Ireland, and I learned it in St. Lawrence Island equally. Granted that both are the, you know, western fringes of what's left of previous cultures, islands off the west coast of something. So St. Lawrence Island and little island off the west coast of Ireland, same thing. Something very special still alive there. That the life of the mind, believe it or not, exists there too, and is perfectly compatible with the life of the mind of academe in the best sense of the word. If it's a hoop jumping three ring circus version of academe, which is this supposedly is here, one may have to wonder a bit, since with one, according to some concept society, you have, I guess, the superiority of intellect, I suppose, is the highest in the president's office, and second highest in the vice president's office, maybe fourth highest at the faculty level, and below the basement in St. Lawrence Island or Minto. The way everything is structured, and I somehow or other have not, I've always had trouble fitting into that kind of structure, and never saw it that way, and find that I have lots more, I find, in common with people in the sub-basement, sometimes than with the ones at the country club or on the golf course.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, the golf courses.
The oil spill on habitat used by birds. And we collected data on a year-round basis. We had multiple cruises a year for a couple of years. And then since then, we've basically cut it back to summer cruises, midsummer cruises, off and on. And we then analyzed the data with respect to the individual species that were most common that we could look at. And then we looked, took bigger, a bigger view of things, and looked at the bird community as a whole. In terms of the individual species analyses, what we saw was about half of the species that we were able to look at showed very dramatic impacts of the spill. But by the time we finished our studies, 2 years after the spill, 2.5 years after the spill, nearly every one of those species had showed recovery in habitat use. It was far more rapid than we expected. In terms of the bird communities, some of those bigger picture groupings of birds, we did that not only because we wanted to know what the bigger picture was. In other words, did the community, bird community, shift from clean water, puffin and murrelet community to gulls, you know, or rats, you know, a nice community to a contaminated community. And again, we saw short-term impacts and very rapid recovery in the bird community as a whole. The nice thing about looking at the community level was it enabled us to incorporate data on other, some of the rare bird species that we really couldn't look at individually. They're just too rare. Most, if you look at nature, you only have a few abundant species, a few moderately abundant species, and a whole bunch, and what you have is a whole bunch of really rare species that are always a problem ecologically to look at.
So what's involved when we speak about recovery? Is it adaptation, for instance? I mean,
no. No, recovery, we defined statistically, and that is if we detected an impact statistically, which was avoidance of a contaminated habitats, for example, we would say there was an impact to habitat use by this species of bird. Now, okay, once we'd identified impacts, then we had to say, okay, how do you find recovery? And recovery was when that statistical difference disappears. It does not say that things are exactly the same as they were. And that is because even in the absence of an oil spill after several years, you wouldn't have the same number of birds as there was before the oil spill. In other words, it takes into account the idea that there's ecological dynamics, there's community dynamics that occur out there, and the community isn't always going to stay the same, regardless of whether there's a catastrophe or not.
Right. Okay. What else? So, overall, what would you say that we should remember from this situation of, and from what happened in Prince William Sound, and what the scientists did in the area, and what the natives did? I mean, what would be a conclusion of this whole interaction? That's a pretty broad question.
I was going to say.
Yeah, so you can answer, you know, whatever comes to mind.
Want.
Yeah.
I think the first thing, the most important thing that comes to mind is we have to make sure we don't end up with a spill like this again. And from my experience in talking to these guys from Exxon, they know only too acutely that it wreaked havoc with the company, it wreaked havoc with their personal lives. They know that that's clearly a major priority within their company, is avoiding it. And I think in terms of just the well-being of lots of different things, of keeping, I've always maintained that keeping a contaminant out of something is always a lot easier than cleaning it up. I mean, everything from people dumping chemicals into the ground, you know, pulling into a rest stop and changing the oil of their car, you know. Once that oil gets into the ground, it becomes a whole lot more difficult to clean than if you just don't let it get there at all. So that's probably the biggest thing that leaped out at me.
Right.
As a result of all this. The other thing is that we, scientifically, we, like I said, we were quite surprised at how rapidly recovery occurred. And that is, and we hadn't thought about it this way in terms of an ecological perturbation, where you have something really substantial happen. It only happens once. It really, we were just astounded at how rapid and resilient the bird community was, and the environment was. I mean, much of that oil that was left there that didn't get cleaned off was gone by the following spring because it got cleaned off in the winter. Now, it would be a totally different story if it was a chronic pollution problem. I don't think the Sound would be doing nearly as well as it is. I think we were also lucky because the water that flows into the Sound is nice clean water that came from upstream in eastern Gulf of Alaska. And if, you know, obviously when they did the cleaning, a lot of the intertidal organisms were killed because it was high pressure hoses and hot water and so on, beyond the stuff that was killed by the oil. And so there was this nice clean area that could reseed all the clams and the mussels and the barnacles and all those things, the algae on the intertidal zone. So if that spill had occurred at the entrance to Prince William Sound, I think it would have been a whole lot more difficult for recovery to have occurred, I think, in many ways.
So that's a very interesting subject here, that even the people in Exxon Valdez felt really, really bad about what happened. I mean, because
the Exxon, yeah.
There's always this picture of a corporation being, you know, impersonal, and people don't actually care if they can make it.
These guys felt really, really bad.
Right.
I mean, and they feel it on a regular basis because the Exxon Valdez oil spill is the now the benchmark that people always mention another spill against, so their company always gets mentioned.
Right. So, but how would you, now that's a difficult question to put, but how come you have people actually from the Exxon Valdez or generally from corporations that are involved in oil spills will give reparations or appeal about the amount of reparation, and none of them actually go to prison or something.
There are cases where that, well, that's because of corporate law in the United States, too.
Okay.
That shields individuals from that kind of thing. But there have been...
The rest of the world, I suppose.
Yeah, and in there have been a few cases in the United States where the company, a corporation, has behaved so egregiously that the judge actually put people who were in charge in prison.
Right.
But generally, corporate law tends to shield people because of that. It's a weakness in the system, I think.
So do you want to speak any at all about your involvement in the court cases? These cases?
I can, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, just give me, what did you testify about? I mean, how many court cases?
I believe there were two main court cases. One was a federal case, and that was about the violations of the Clean Water Act and so on. And then there was a state case. And the state case was the one that I was involved with both of them, but I never testified in the federal case. I was deposed and so on, which is a legal term in the United States where if you're going to be, let's say you're going to testify, the people who are suing against you, your opponents, have the right to take you and have you questioned under oath, and it's taped,
yeah,
and the whole thing, they make a transcript of it, and that can then be used against you or against somebody else if they think it will help their case in court.